Okay.
Okay.
So chapter one, Bill's story, page one. It says, war fever ran high in New England town to which we new young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned. We were flattered when the first citizens that took us into their homes, making us feel heroic. Back in the First World War, when the young lads were coming back from war and they were walking down their streets with their uniforms on, they were getting cheers from the crowd and being brought into their houses. And he said, moments sublime, intervals hilarious. He enjoyed life because he felt part of life. And the people that were in America were welcoming them home because they were doing a good job in the war, right? The first citizens took us into their homes, making us feel heroic. Here was love, applause, war, moments sublime, intervals hilarious. And he said, I was part of life at last. Bill was a bit of a loner, right? And in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. And I underlined this because we're straight into Bill's story. And he's now going to tell us that there was a problem with booze in the early days that he recognized. He said, I discovered liquor. And I highlighted the next three lines. He said, I forgot the strong warnings of the prejudice of my people concerning drink. Bill's father was an alcoholic. And what happened was his family had said to him, Bill, be careful because your father's an alcoholic. Be careful of the drink problem because you're drinking too much. And Bill was getting problems and consequences. But Bill couldn't see it. But he wrote it into his story. He said, in time with South over there, I was very lonely. And again, he says, I underlined this. I again turned to alcohol. Second time he's mentioned it in the first part of his story. We landed in England and I visited Winchester Cathedral. Much love, I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a doggerel, which is an inscription, on an old tombstone, which I'd visited, which is not far from where I live. And it says, here lies a Hampshire grenadier. He was a soldier, and so was Bill, who caught his death drinking cold small beer. And Bill's already mentioned a beer, the drink problem. He said, a good soldier's never forgot whether he died by musket or by pot. And back in England in them days, it wasn't pot hash. Beers was drunk in the big tankards, the big pot, and that's what he meant, that's what he's referring to. And I underline this next sentence, it says, ominous warnings, which I failed to heed. Because now this is the third time, another warning, the drink is becoming a bit of a problem into his life. He said, 22 and a veteran of foreign wars, I went home at last. I fancied myself a leader, for had I not been, the men of my battery give me a special token of appreciation. My talent for leadership, I imagine, would place me at the head of vast empires, enterprises, which I'd manage with the utmost assurance. Because Bill was a bit of a big shot. He thought he knew best. He was a leader. He wanted to be in control. We all recognise that part of self-centeredness, right? He said, I took a night law course and obtained employment as an investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I'd proved to the world that I was important. My work took me about Wall Street, and little by little, I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich. Why not I, with a question mark? And now he's on the chase for money, right? I started economics and business as well, and I underlined this next sentence. He said, potential alcoholic that I was. The third time we are now, he's reminded us about alcoholism, right? Potential alcoholic that I was. I nearly failed my law course, and at one of the finals, and underlined it, I was too drunk to think all right. Page two, and he's mentioned about alcohol over and over. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed his wife. Lois was saying to Bill, come on, Bill, why do you keep drinking? It's affecting our home life and our relationships and our finances. Why don't you just stop? And like all of us, Bill just said, you know what? It's not a problem. I can stop when I want to stop, right? He said, we had long talks when I would still her forebodings by telling her men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk. He bullshit, all right? Telling her a pack of lies. When I'm drunk, I think of great things that I'm going to earn money from. That the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived or brought on. By the time I completed the course, I knew that law was not for me. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. Business and financial leaders were my hero. And I highlighted the next four lines. He said, out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced, and underlined this, to forge the weapon He's talking about drink. Yeah. I commenced to forge a weapon that would one day turn in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. And next to that, I wrote alcoholic. Because he formed the habit. Silk was explained that once having formed a habit, we found it hard to break. And Bill said, out this alloy of drink, he forged a weapon that was going to come back and get him, but like a boomerang. And it was alcoholic and alcoholism. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. He went into certain securities, then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagined that they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and managements, but my wife decided to go anyway. I developed a theory that most people lost money in stock through ignorance of markets. I discovered more reasons later on. They wouldn't send Bill away on business trips because he was a drunk, because he kept getting drunk. He then said, we gave up our positions and off we roared on a motorcycle. The sidecar stuffed with tent blankets and a change of clothes and three huge volumes of financial reference service. Bill went down the Eastern Seaboard and he went into factories and working men's clubs and he asked the guys there, how's business? How are we doing? Are you earning? And then he'd find out whether their business was successful so he could earn money into it, so he could invest into it. So he wrote a financial reference of each and every company that he asked questions of. And he then said, our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. I had some success in speculation. And so we had little money, but we once worked on the farm to avoid drawing our small capital. And I underlined his next sentence. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day. Because now drink is taking over and we're only on page three, right? We covered the whole Eastern United States in a year. And at the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me a position there and the use of a large expense account. He took the financial reference books and he showed them to his employers and they gave him a job. He said, well, Bill, you've been doing your work and doing your homework and you've learned about it. Now we're going to give you a job and we're going to give you a position with a large expense account, right? Money was no object. He said, yeah, the exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us with profit of several thousand dollars that year. For the next few months, fortune threw money and applause my way and underlined this, I had arrived. Because Bill wanted to be successful. He wanted to be something in life. And now he feels he's important. But the underlying part of his condition, he's an alcoholic. And it's not quite come to the forefront just yet. My judgment and ideas were followed to many to the tune of paper millions. The great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. And I highlight this next sentence. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. There was loud talking at jazz places uptown. Everyone spending thousands in chatters and millions. Scoffers could scoff and to be damned. I made a host of fair weather friends. The fair weather friends were the ones that would go home from the bar to their wives, to their children, to their families. Bill stayed at the bar. So they become fair weather friends because Bill was a drunk and he wouldn't leave the bar. They would leave him and leave him to it. And they become fair weather friends, not true alcoholics like we know. And I highlighted this, my drinking assumed more serious proportions, consuming all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row and I became a lone wolf. There were many unhappy scenes at our sumptuous apartment. I highlighted all of that because now the problem's at home. He's losing his friends at the bar. He's losing his friends at work. And he's having trouble at home. There had been no real infidelity for loyalty to my wife, helped by many times by extreme drunk and me kept me out of those scrapes. And what he means is he couldn't cheat on his wife because he was too drunk. That's what he'd done. He was too drunk to cheat. In 1929, I attracted gold fever. We went at once to the country, my wife to applaud, while I started to overtake Walter Hagen, who was a top American golfer back in the 1920s and 30s. And underlined this, liquor caught up with me again. Much faster than I came up behind water. I began to be jittery in the morning. And now he's an alcoholic. And the only one who doesn't know that is Bill. Golf permitted drinking every day and every night. It was fun to carom around the exclusive courses, which had inspired such awe in me as a lad. I'd acquired the impeccable coat of a tan, one seized on the well-to-do. The local banker watched me whirl fat checks in and out of his till with amused skepticism, because the banker knew it was going to come down. He knew it was going to crash. Abruptly, in October 1929, this is the New York, the Wall Street crash, broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. After one of those days of inferno, and I highlighted the rest of this paragraph. I wobbled from the hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock. 5 hours after the market closed, the ticker still cracked. I was staring at an inch of tape which bore the inscription XYZ 32. It had been 52 that morning, the Wall Street crash. Many people died, and many people lost money, and many businesses went skint and went broke. He said, I was finished, and so were many of my friends. The papers reported men jumping to the death from the towers of high finance. I underlined that one sentence because it becomes operative in 2 pages' time. The papers reported men jumping from the death of the towers of high finance, and that disgusted me. And I highlighted that because it becomes apparent. Bill said, I would not jump. I went back to the bar. My friends have dropped several million since 10 o'clock. So what? Tomorrow's another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. Next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. He had plenty of money left, and I thought I'd better go to Canada, the first geographical, right? By the following spring, we were living our accustomed style. I felt like Napoleon returning from St. Elba. No St. Helena from me. And I underlined the next three lines. But drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time we stayed broke. Now Bill's got the sack. He'd done the geographical. He stayed sober for 6 to 9 months. Drinking caught up again, and he got the sack. We went to live with my wife's parents, and I found a job. And then I lost it as a result of a brawl with a taxi driver. Mercifully, no one could guess that I was to have no real employment. And I underlined this: for 5 years, I hardly draw a sober breath. Now Bill's a drunk. We're going to take 5 years of pain and suffering and torment, plus 2 more years before this guy gets sober. My wife began to work for a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. She's too drunk to work. No one would employ him. He said, I'd become an unworker hanging on at the brokerage places. He would turn up at the brokerage office, and the boss would say, Bill, you can't come in smelling like this. You smell bad. You look bad. You're putting customers away. You can't come in. And I underlined the next sentence. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. And next to that, I wrote alcoholic. Because now he's a hopeless drunk. He has no job. He has problems at home. And he can't stay sober for love nor money. He said, bathtub gin. Bathtub gin was the cheapest gin you could get, and chemicals that he would throw into a bathtub, and he would stir it with a brush and put it into bottles and drink. A bit like the White Lightning, the cheapest liquor that you can get nowadays. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day, and often 3, got to be the routine. Sometimes a small deal would net me a few hundred dollars. And I like this. I would pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens. He never put food on the table. He never paid the bills. He never treated like this. He'd run a tab at every delicatessen, every liquor store. He'd run a tab up, and when he made a few hundred dollars, he'd go and pay them first so he could drink more. He's the real alcoholic, right? This went on endlessly. I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumbler full of gin, followed by a half dozen bottles of beer, would be required if I was to eat any breakfast. Nevertheless, and I underlined this, I still thought I could control the situation, the obsession. There were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. Gradually, things got worse. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. The mother-in-law died, and my wife and father-in-law became ill. I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at a low point of 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I also shared generously in the profits, and I highlighted this next sentence. He said, I went on a prodigious bender, a huge bender, huge drink, and the chance vanished. He lost that opportunity for a drink to make a pile of money, to pay the bills, to look after Lois, but he chose to get drunk. The obsession took over yet again, right? And I highlighted this from my woke up right to the bottom of the page. The whole thing is so important. He said, I woke up. This had to be stopped. He knew it was a problem. Bill was now knowing he was powerless over alcohol, but he still could not stop. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I'd written lots of sweet promises, but my wife had happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Now he's not going to stop. On his own power, he's made that decision. I'm not going to drink again. He then said shortly afterward, and I underlined this, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply did not know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way and I'd taken it. And I underlined this with an exclamation mark. Was I crazy? Because now Bill sees the repetition of what he's doing. He can see there's no way out. He can see he cannot stop. He knows he's crazy because he keeps taking that first drink. What am I going to do? He was in despair. He said, I began to wonder for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that, renewing my resolve. So he's now sober again. I tried again. Some time had passed. We all got 3 months, right? And confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. Now he thought he had the answer. He said, I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into the cafe to telephone in no time, underlined this, I was beaten on the bar. Asking myself how it happened, as the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time. But I might as well get good and drunk. And then I did. And he had managed 3 months sober. But the insanity came in and it blocked out the consequences. And the obsession justified the next drink. And he got drunk after 3 months. He said the remorse and horror and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. I highlighted that. The morning after, the waking up with that hangover. What did I do last night? The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. Bill was beat. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there's a terrible sense of impending calamity because now he's waiting for Lois to come up to tell him, do you know what you did last night? Do you know what you got up to? I had hardly dared cross the street lest I collapse and be run over by an early morning truck. For it was scarcely daylight. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale, which went on his tab. My arriving nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell, and I highlighted his next four lines. He said, so, well, so had I. The market would recover. I would not. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself now with a question mark? And that's the desperation that Bill got to. No, not now. The mental fog settled down. Gin would fix that. Two bottles and oblivion. The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms. The mind endured his agony for 2 more years. This is now 7 years as a chronic, hopeless, powerless alcoholic. Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. She was going down and working at Macy's department store, coming home exhausted. And when she went to bed, Bill was stealing from her purse just to feed his alcoholism. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for being a weakling. There were flights from city to country and back as my wife and I sought escape. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture was so hellish. And remember, I spoke about the towers of high finance. This is a reference to it. Because he said it disgusted me when they jumped. when they quit at the Towers of High Finance. Okay. And then he said this: "The physical mental torture was so hellish, I feared I would burst through my window sash and all." Now Bill's going to jump. Now Bill wants to kill himself because he can't cope. And yet, 2 pages ago, disgusted him at the thought of somebody breaking because of the New York Stock Exchange. "Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor, lest I suddenly leap. A doctor came with some heady sedative." This was his brother-in-law, Dr. Strong, Leonard Strong. "Next day, he found me drinking both gin and sedative. This combination soon landed me on the rocks." And I highlighted this next 3 lines: "People feared for my sanity, and so did I. I could eat little or nothing when I was drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight." Now Bill's beat. "My brother-in-law is a physician, and through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital, which is Towns Hospital in New York, for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics under the so-belladonna treatment. My brain cleared. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much. But best of all, I met a kind doctor, who's Dr. Silkworth." Remember, from the doctor's opinion, right? "Who explained, though certainly selfish and foolish, I've been seriously ill, and I underline this, bodily and mentally, the only two symptoms of alcoholism. It's not the spiritual malady, it's not trauma, not any other problems, it's the mind and body. He said it relieved me somewhat to learn it in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects." This is all step one, by the way. "My incredible behavior in the face of desperate desire to stop was explained." Now he knows why he can't stop, because Silkworth told him he's got an allergy to alcohol. This is what you've got, Bill. This is why you keep getting drunk when you take that first drink. He said, "Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope." I underlined this next 4 lines. He said, "For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money." He said, "Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge." Underline self-knowledge. Because Bill believed, "Now I know what I've got, I'm just not going to drink." He didn't know about lack of power. He didn't know he needed a God. He just knew what the problem was, that he cannot take that one drink. He said, "But it was not. For the frightful day came again." And I highlighted this, the bottom of this page from there. "But it's not. The frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump." Now he's beat. "After a time, I returned to the hospital." This is his second visit. "This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed, for me. My weary and despairing wife was informed it would all end in heart failure during delirium tremens." Silkworth spoke with Lois Wilson in the hallway outside of his bed and said, "If Bill doesn't stop, he's going to die. We need to get him sober because he can't stop on his own. Or I'll develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would soon have to hand me over to the undertaker or the asylum. They did not need to tell me, I knew, and I almost welcomed the idea." Because Bill had no way out. Even with the self-knowledge, he kept getting drunk. He said, "It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities, of my capacity to surmount obstacles, I was cornered at last. Now I was to plunge into the dark, joining that endless procession of sots or drunks who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was all over now." And I highlighted this whole page now, the rest of page 8 and all of page 9, because it's important in Bill's story. He said, "No words can tell the loneliness and despair that we've all had, found in a bitter morass of self-pity." He said, "Quicksand stretched around me in all directions." That means he had no way out. He knew he was beat. He was cornered at last. "I'd met my match. I'd been overwhelmed." I underlined this. Alcohol was my master because he could not beat it. He'd admitted defeat. He said, trembling, I stepped from the hospital, a broken man. And then he said, fear sobered me for a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of the first drink. And on Armistice 1934, I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I'd have to be shut up somewhere or stumble along to a miserable end. And I underlined this sentence, how dark it is before the dawn, because a way out is coming. Bill's at his low point. There's no way out. He has no hope. He said, in reality, this is the beginning of my last debauch or drunk. I was soon to be catapulted, and underline this, to what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence, the way out, the solution. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Near the end of the bleak November, we're talking of 11th of November 1934, I was sat drinking in my kitchen. With a certain satisfaction, I reflected, there was enough gin concealed about my house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dared hide a bottle of gin at the head of our bed. I will need it before daylight. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. This is Ebby Thatcher. Ebby Thatcher was a schoolboy friend at this point who was 6 weeks sober from the Oxford group. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over, and I underlined this, he was sober. But he always said, if I ever get as bad as Ebby, you best lock me up. But Ebby's now sober. He said it was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumour had said it that he'd been committed away for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he'd escaped. Of course, I would have dinner and then I could drink openly with him, unmindful of his welfare. I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. There was that time when we chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was the oasis in the dreary desert of futility. The very thing an oasis drinkers are like that. And I highlighted the rest of this page. Because now we're going to see where Bill gets a bit of hope. And Bill gets a little bit of belief that there's a way out. Because Ebby was always drunk and Bill could never see Ebby getting sober. But Ebby's now in front of him in the kitchen. And he says, the door opened and he stood there, fresh skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes that was inexplicably different. What had happened? Bill wanted to know how Ebby got sober, because Bill couldn't do it on his own. He never knew there was a way out. He knew from Silkworth there was a problem, an allergic reaction. He said, I pushed a drink across the table and he refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what got into the fellow. He wasn't himself. Come, Bill said, what's all this about? I queried. Ebby looked straight at me and simply but smiling, he said, Bill, I've got religion. He don't drink no more. Ebby's 6 weeks, looking good, smelling good. He said, I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspected a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yes, the old boy was on fire all right. And that's what I see with the newcomers. That's what I've seen with people in the groups I attend, Linda more so than anybody. They're on fire. They look different. They look inexplicably different, right? But bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. And this next paragraph is important because he said, but he did no ranting. Ebby didn't preach to him. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court, persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action, and that was 2 months ago. And the result was self-evident. It worked. Now Bill could see there was a program in action. Bill knew the problem from Dr. Silkworth, and he could see the program in action for his friend, Ebby Thatcher. He said he had come to pass on his experience along to me, if I'd care to have it. I was shocked but interested, certainly was interested. I had to be, and I underline this, he said, for I was hopeless. Hopeless means godless, means powerless. He talked for hours, childhood memories rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat on still Sundays way over there on the hillside. There was that proper temperance pledge that I never signed. My grandfather's good natured contempt of some church folder and their doing. His insistence that the spheres really had their music, but his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen. Bill's grandfather wasn't religious. He didn't believe in religion. He didn't believe in a church. He wouldn't sign the church temperance pledge. And he told Bill and his sister Dorothy, do not sign that. But believe in something, Bill, because there's something out there. But it's not God of the cross. It's exactly what he said. He said his fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died. These recollections welled up in the past and made me swallow hard. That wartime day in the old Winchester Cathedral came back again. Remember the dog war on the old tombstone? He's now remembering because Ebbie Thatcher's sitting in front of him. And the guy on the tombstone was Thomas Thatcher, which is what he recognized when he was in Winchester. Bill said, I'd always believed in a power greater than myself, underlined that. Bill was open-minded to a power. I'd often pondered these things. I was not an atheist, for few people really are. But that means blind faith in a strange proposition. And this universe originated in a cipher and AMC rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even evolutionists suggested that vast laws and forces were at work. He believed in something. He was open-minded and liberal enough to try and understand that. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could there be so much of precise, immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in the spirit of the universe, which, as we know, will be step two. Who knew he needed no time nor limitation, but that was as far as I could. With ministers, the world's religions, I parted right there. When they talked of a God personal to me, whose love, superhuman strength and direction, I became irritated at my mind snapped against such a theory. He didn't believe in God. He didn't want religion. Top of 11, to Christ I conceded the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him, his disciples. His moral teaching, most excellent. For myself, I'd adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest I disregarded, because Bill was willing to believe. Bill wasn't quite so close-minded. The wars which had been fought, the burnings and the chicanery, that religious dispute which had facilitated, made me sick. I honestly doubted whether, on balance, the religions of mankind had done any good. Judging from what I'd seen in Europe and since, the power of God in human affairs was negligible. The brother of man, a grim jest. If there was a devil, he seemed the boss universal, and he certainly had me, because Bill knew he was hopeless. And I highlighted from here on all of the bottom of page 11. He says, but a friend sat before me. He made point the blank declaration and underlined this, that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Ebbie couldn't stop on his own power. Bill couldn't stop on his own self-will and own power. And he had to find the power. And what Bill witnessed was Ebbie coming to Bill with God in his corner, because Ebbie had found the power that solved the problem, because Ebbie hadn't drunk for 6 weeks. He said doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. And I underlined these next few words. He says, like myself, he'd admitted complete defeat. Bill took step one in the kitchen while drinking. He'd admitted complete defeat. He couldn't stop on his own. Hopeless, godless, powerless. He then said he had then, in effect, been raised up from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he'd ever known. Powerful words. Had this power originated in him? Obviously, it had not. There'd been no more power on him at that time than there was at me at that minute, and this was none at all. That floored me. It began to look as though the religious people were right after all. Here was something at work in the human heart which had done the impossible. Stop heavy drinking. My ideas and miraculously and about miracles were drastically revised right then. Never mind the musty past, here sat a miracle directly across the table He shouted, "Great tidings, step two." Because Bill could see it in somebody else. He was now willing to believe. He said, "I saw that my friend was much more inwardly. All the steps work for the mind and not the body. It's an inward spiritual awakening. Inwardly reorganized." And I underlined this next sentence on the top 12. He's on a different footing. Because now Ebby's got God's story, not Ebby's story. Ebby's will had gone. And he's now living a life of God's will because he's carrying a message to Bill, his schoolboy friend, wondering how he's doing. He said, "His roots grasped a new soil. Despite the living example of my old friend, here remain the vestiges of my old prejudice. The word God still aroused certain antipathy. But when the thought was expressed to me," and underline this, "to be a God personal to me, first, the feeling was intensified. I didn't like the idea. I could go to such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of the Tsar of the heavens, however loving his sway may be. I have since talked with scores of men who have felt the same way. Agnostics. They didn't want to believe. They didn't know how to believe. My friend suggested, which seemed a novel idea, he said," and I underlined this, "why don't you choose your own conception of God, Bill? Doesn't have to be Jesus. Doesn't have to be God. It can be the chemist, the astronomers, the power of the universe. Anything you want to be, the spirit of the universe. You choose it." Bill said that statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectuals' mountains whose shadow I'd lived in and shivered for many years. I stood in the sunlight at life, at last. His next two lines of a step two question. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? It's the step two question. And Bill said, "Of course I would." Bill's now took step two while drinking in the kitchen with his bathtub gin because he can see the evidence in front of him. He can see the proof. Thus, I was convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want him enough. At long last, I saw, I felt, I believed. Scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. He now become open-minded. A new world came into view. The real significance of my experience in the cathedral burst upon me from the old tombstone. For a brief moment, I'd needed and wanted God. There ran a humble willingness to have him with me. He came. But soon the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamours, mostly within myself. And so it had been ever since. How blind that I've been. Now Bill was going to go back for his third detox. He said, "At the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. I highlighted the whole page." This is when Bill's going to go through the whole program. In them days, it's the Oxford Group tenancy, went through the absolutes, but we're going to distinguish it as the steps as we go through. This is step three. He said, "There, I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him, to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself, I was nothing, and that without him, I was lost." And step three. And the next three lines are step six and seven. "I ruthlessly faced my sins, my defects, and became willing to have my newfound friend with a capital F, which is God, take them away root and branch. I've not had a drink since." That's six and seven. This is steps four and five. "My schoolmate visited me, Ebby, in the hospital, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and my deficiencies." That's steps four and five. The next four lines are eight and nine. "We made a list of people I had hurt toward them, whom I felt resentment. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to write such matters to the utmost of my ability." Steps eight and nine. And the next part from here down is 10, 11, and 12. It says, "I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within." Step 10, right? Common sense will thus become uncommon sense. Because in step 10, it says, for by this time, sanity is returned, right? I'll sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems, happy would have me. Step 11. Never was I to pray for myself, except that my request bore my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. And from the bottom now, step 12. My friend promised me. Step 12, promise. When these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship, spiritual awakening, with my Creator. That I'd have the elements of a way of living, which is the program, which answered, and underlined this, all my problems. Because it said in step 4, all of our problems are of our own making. We created them. Belief in the power of God, plus in us willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain a new order of things were the essential requirements. That's step 12. It says simple but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. Next to that, I wrote page 62. I must turn all things over to the Father of Light who presides over us all. These were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I'd ever known. There was an utter confidence. I felt lifted up. I highlighted this next few lines. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. For a moment, I was alarmed. I called my friend, a doctor, to ask him if I was still sane. He listened in wonder as I talked. Finally, he shook his head and said, "This is Dr. Silkworth. Bill, something has happened to you. I don't understand, but you better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were." Because Bill was hopeless, remember? Bill saw him laying in the bed when he spoke about quicksand stretched all around. And now he's had a spiritual experience going through the steps of Abby. And Silkworth sees a different man. And he said, "Bill, you better hang on to this. You better keep what you've got. Anything is better than the way you worked." The good doctor now sees many men who've had such experiences. He knows they are real. While I lay in the hospital, the thought came to mind. There were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what we've been so freely given to me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They in turn might work with others. Now, if Bill had laid there, I said, "I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to keep it for myself. I'm not going to pass it on." Where would we be today? Because Bill was the pioneer of AA. Bill was what put us all together and brought us what we've got today. He then said, my friend had emphasized the absolute necessity, underlined this, the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others. I highlight that whole paragraph. We need to carry the message. We need to pass it on. Bill knew when he got sober, this is our message that we need to carry. This is step 12. As he had worked with me, and underlined his faith without works was dead. If you do not sponsor, you will not enlarge your spiritual life. He said, and now appallingly so for true alcoholics, for if an alcoholic failed to enlarge, effectively enlarge his spiritual life, and underlined all of this through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. If he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed with us. It's just like that. Bottom of 14, top of 15, powerful words. We need to carry the message. My wife and I abandoned ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping other alcoholics to a solution to their problems. It was fortunate for my old business associates remained skeptical for a year. They gave him some business, but they wasn't sure because they kept seeing Bill relapse. And a half, during which I found little work. I was not too well at the time. I was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink. But I soon found, and underlined this, that when all other measures failed, working with another alcoholic would save the day. Many times I've gone to my old hospital in despair, and on talking to a man there, I'd be amazingly lifted up, set on my feet. And I highlight this, it's a design for living that works in rough going. There's your answer. There's your solution. We commenced to make many fast friends, and a fellowship has grown among us, which is a wonderful thing to feel a part of. The joy of living we really have. Even under pressure and difficulty, I have seen hundreds of families set their feet in a path that really goes somewhere. And I've seen the most impossible domestic situations righted. Feuds and bitterness of all sorts wiped out. I've seen men come out of asylums and resume a vital place in their lives of their families and communities. Business and professional men have regained their standing. This is the fellowship of AA, right? There is scarcely any form of trouble or misery which has not been overcome among us. In one Western city and its environs, there are thousands of us and our families. We meet frequently so that newcomers may find the fellowship they seek. At these informal gatherings, we may often see from 50 to 200 persons. We are growing in numbers and power. An alcoholic in his cups when drunk is an unlovely creature. Our struggles with them are variously strenuous, comic and tragic. One poor chap committed suicide in my home. He hung himself in Bill's basement naked. And Lois was the one that found him. He could not or would not see our way of life. There is, however, a vast amount of fun about it. I suppose some will be shocked at our seeming levity, worldliness and levity. But just underneath, there's deadly earnestness. And I like this next sentence. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us or we perish. That means we work the program. We live the program and we carry the message. Most of us feel we need look no further for utopia. We have it with us right here and now. Each day, my friend's simple talk in our kitchen multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth and a goodwill to all men. And just remember one thing as we finish off. Bill was the pioneer. He was the author of the book. He was one that brought the message to us and for us to carry that on.